This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk. And today we have a very special guest, Charles Ardai, and he has a book, a whole bunch of hard case crime novels that have come out. This is number 112. Is that right? Number 112?
It is number 112, but there's a secret there. We published our first 66 books with a company called Dorchester Publishing, and then they went out of business. They were the folks who manufactured our books and got them to stores. Then they went under. It was a sad day. And we switched to a new publisher, Titan Books, and when we did that, we renumbered. We said, we're not going to publish book 67 as our first Titan book. We're going to make that 101, so that, like comic book publishers who love to always have an issue number one for collectors, we said we're going to have a new issue number one. And in fact, our first book ever with Dorchester was a Lawrence Block novel called Grifter's Game. That was Hard Case Crime 001. Right. And so we made Hard Case Crime 101 another Lawrence Block book called Getting Off. So we have had fewer than 112 books because there were no books between 66 and 101.
Interesting.
Although even that, there's a secret there, which is that we've done two special one-off collectible books that we numbered HCC 069 and HCC 070. So the story is far too complicated, but hardcore collectors can figure it out.
Right. We should tell people you're the actual publisher of all these books. People are thinking, well, how do you know so much about all these books? He's the actual publisher.
Yes, I am the editor, the publisher, chief bottle washer. It's really a labor of love. My friend Max and I were both novelists. We'd worked together. And back in the winter of 2001, we started talking about the idea of starting a line of pulp fiction. It took us 3 years to get any publisher to pay attention to us, work with us on it. But we began publishing these books in 2004, and it's been almost a decade of doing it. We never thought we'd keep doing it this long. But anyway, I'm the only one who works. I don't even work full time on it. I work part time on it, and Max does the graphic design. I do the editing. But we don't have a staff. We don't have assistants. We don't have an office. It's all just a labor of love.
Is this Max Allen Collins you're talking about?
No, it's actually Max Phillips.
Max Phillips. There's another Max.
There are so many Maxes. The funny thing is, so Max Phillips wrote our second book, Fate to Blonde, and it won the Seamus Award for Best Paperback Private Eye Novel.
Congratulations.
Which is great. And Max is just a, thank you. He's a very gifted writer. And when the 50th book came around, I decided I would write that one myself. It's called 50 to 1. It was a celebration of all of our 50 books.
Yeah, what a great idea that was.
Oh, well, thanks. The gimmick was we would tell the story. I would tell the story in 50 chapters, and each chapter would be titled after one of the books in order. And I had to come up with a story that made sense of our 50 book titles in order. So the first book was called Grifter's Game, so chapter 1 was Grifter's Game. The second book was Fate to Blonde. I had to write a chapter called Fate to Blonde, and so on. It was a nightmare, but it was a lot of fun to do. And we published a book called The Max. It was book number 47, I think. And so I got Max Phillips to write the chapter in 50 to 1 called The Max. I just didn't tell anybody that. It was, you know, little in-jokes, Easter eggs. We have fun with it.
That's really, really clever. I mean, when I first heard about those 50 chapters, I thought, that's so cool. I mean, how in the world do you come up with a story that makes sense with all those 50 chapter titles?
It was hard. I wouldn't do it again. So, for example, when we hit our 100th book, I'm not going to do 100 to 1 and come up with 100 chapters. That would be too hard. And even as it is, with 50 chapters, some of the reviewers said, yes, this is a funny book. It's a good book, but it's a little long. It would have been better with only 40 chapters. But I couldn't do it with 40 chapters. You missed the whole point. But yeah, I had fun doing it, but it was it had sort of the quality of a finger exercise when you have a virtuoso pianist playing some very difficult piece. It was a very difficult piece to play, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the best book in the line.
Now, we're focusing on the new one, Joyland, the Stephen King novel, and we'll get into how that came about. But like you said, there's a ton of these books, and you can get them in all your bookstores or online or wherever, Amazon. And are they all e-books now?
Not all of them. When we started the line, ebooks weren't a big deal, so we didn't even bother buying ebook rights. We always asked if we could, but sometimes the authors said no. So we only got ebook rights to maybe half of our first 66 books. We've gotten ebook rights to all of the ones we've done since then. Except we haven't done an e-book of Joyland, and that's gotten a fair amount of publicity. Stephen King decided he wanted people's experience of this book, which is very much about nostalgia, and it's about old pleasures. It's set in the 1970s. It takes place in a small-town local amusement park in North Carolina, and he wanted this book that has such an old-fashioned, old-time, nostalgic flavor to be experienced on paper. He said, I want people's initial experience of this book to be the way I experienced books in 1973, on paper. And we were proud to do that. We were very retro, and we're deliberately imitating the visual style of old paperbacks, and we were very happy to say, okay, Joyland will only be in paper, initially. Eventually, I'm sure there will be an e-book edition eventually, but initially, this year, it's only paper.
But it's up to Stephen King. He has to be the one that says yes.
Yes, it's up to Stephen King, absolutely. But we do have e-book rights to all the other books we've done since switching from Dorchester to Titan.
It's so interesting to hear you talk all about this. I mean, your excitement of it is all over your voice. I mean,
well, thank you. It's the most fun I've had. I've done a lot of things over the years, both in publishing and outside. I started an internet company called Juno. If anyone out there listening to this has ever sent or received an email message from an email address that ends at juno.com, that's something I created.
I've worked in
other fields. But hard case crime is just a joy for me. And, this is also why Stephen King got involved. You know, he saw these books. They looked like the books he grew up reading, the books he loved. And he said, I want to be part of the fun. You know, I want to be, he didn't literally say those words, but it was very clear that he wanted to be part of the fun. And we were thrilled to have him. We want people who look at these old style books and say, that's delicious. You know, that's something that, that's uniquely American. It's a uniquely American type of entertainment, just like the movies, that come out of Hollywood, Broadway shows. It's just one of the great American pleasures. And for many years, you just couldn't find books that looked like this in bookstores, on newsstands. They were huge in the 1940s, 50s, even the 60s. But then they started falling off in the 70s, and by the 80s, 90s, you just didn't see them. And so we said, let's bring this back. This is just such a great lost art form. Let's put out super, fast storytelling and crackling dialogue and great story hooks that capture your imagination on the first page, and you don't have to read 500 pages and find out about the character's childhood. These are short books. These are usually 200 to 300 page books, and you can read them in a night or two, and the covers have beautiful women on them and tough guys with guns.
Beautiful women in lingerie, some of them.
In lingerie or out of lingerie, either way. we have fun, and they're all paintings. You know, we get email from models sometimes, which is not the worst job a man could have, getting emails from models. And they say, I'd like to pose for one of your covers, and we say, I don't know if you were aware of this, but they're paintings. They're not photographs. Some of our painters do photograph models to give them reference to paint from, so they see, how the bones move under the skin, how cloth drapes, but not one of our covers is a photograph. They're all paintings. And this is what you used to see on books. Every book had a painting on the cover. These days, most books just have text on the cover. You just see the author's name in big letters and maybe a little tiny spot illustration of a bird or a baseball bat or something. But in the old days, you had these beautiful, lurid covers that sucked you in. You said to yourself, I've got to buy that book. I need to know what that painting is about. I need to know what that cover is about. And then half the time when you read the book, the scene on the cover never appeared in the book. But you had already paid your money, so the publisher was happy.
It sort of reminded me of the beginning of this book of Thinner, when he goes book by
the Gypsy Curse.
Yeah, I mean, the woman in the beginning who's telling him what's going to happen to him, and of course he doesn't believe it. But
yeah, we were talking just before we started recording this. We were talking about whether this is or isn't typical Stephen King, Joyland, that is. And there are ways in which it is and ways in which it isn't. I think there are elements in this book that no one else would ever write, and they're pure Stephen King through and through. Somebody who read The Body, which became the movie Stand By Me, or Shawshank Redemption, or The Green Mile, or Hearts in Atlantis, will find the kind of emotional center that the Joyland is all about. And as you say, the Gypsy Curse in Thinner has something in common with the palm reader and crystal ball reader in Joyland, who's presumably a fraud. You know, all these psychics and all the carnivals around the country are all frauds, right? Except this one maybe isn't.
I mean, who isn't fascinated by a psychic? When you pass by their store, you think, well, what if I went in there and they told me something that came true? What would that? We're all. I mean, it's
have you ever tried it?
No, I never have.
I tried once. This is my favorite psychic story. There was a storefront psychic on Second Avenue in New York City where I grew up. You had to climb a flight of stairs, a rickety, horrible flight of stairs in a tenement building, but she had a window, and on the window it said psychic. And I knocked on the door, and this wizened old woman peered her head out around the door and stared at me and said, "No, no, not you," and slammed the door in my face. And of course, the real answer to why she did that was probably she was having dinner, she was taking a shower, she was busy, she was watching her favorite TV show. But of course, she said it in that ominous voice, and I thought, oh no, clearly my future is so bleak, so terrible, that she refuses to tell me what it is. But that was when I was, whatever, 19 years old, and clearly my future's been okay since. So I think it really was just that she had dinner on the stove.
Why do I get the feeling Stephen King is like an oversized kid?
Aren't we all? Aren't we all oversized kids? I think Stephen King has had the good fortune of having the best job in the world for the last 40 years. He's been writing every story that comes to him. Every one of them has been a bestseller. Every one of them has reached hundreds of thousands or millions of readers. And what job could a storyteller enjoy more than having a kind of global campfire, right? You know, most storytellers have a little campfire, and they have three or four friends or family members around it. They tell the ghost story, and few people get scared. But Stephen King gets to tell around a campfire of millions. What a wonderful experience he's had. Not to say his life hasn't had hardship in it, because it has early on and later. But I think he appreciates just how much fun he's having and how terrific his job is.
I was reading in the Entertainment Weekly about Under the Dome, which I think was the first episode was on last night. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to be watching it. But you look in the arc, you look at his face, he looks like he's having fun. It's like somebody, the man can do basically whatever he wants, and it's just nice to see that. I mean, it's
true. You know, when you see a rock performer, you see a singer or a musician, and they get on stage and they sit at the piano or they pick up the guitar and their face lights up. It's like that. The only difference is that the work of being a writer is usually private, and you don't get to see them do it. So you see when Billy Joel's at the piano and really enjoying himself. You don't see when Stephen King's at his keyboard. So these interviews, these photo shoots that he does once in a blue moon are the one chance you get to see that smile on his face. But believe me, when you work with him on a book, it comes through all the time. It comes through in the emails you exchange. It comes through on the page. You know, you can't read Joyland and not recognize that this is the work of a man who loves what he does.
Now, I see Glenn Orbick is the one that did the cover for this one. Now, does he do a lot of your covers?
He does. We've out of 80 or so books we've published, he's probably done covers for a dozen, and he's one of our very best. We had a hardcover edition of Joyland as well, a very small hardcover edition. I think we printed close to a million copies of the paperback, and that's all over the country. But we only printed 2,000 copies, roughly, of a hardcover for collectors. And the cover of that edition was different. That was done by Robert McGinnis, who is a very famous painter. His most famous work was probably the original James Bond movie posters with Sean Connery. And he also did the poster of Audrey Hepburn with the cigarette holder for Breakfast at Tiffany's. So he's done some...
What does the cover look like? I'm curious.
That one, you can find it on our website, and anyone listening here can go to www.hardcasecrime.com. You can see all of our covers, including this one. It's a picture of a woman on a beach. She's wearing a black bikini. She's holding a long rifle, and in the distance across the water is the Joyland Amusement Park, and in the sky, the storm is coming. It's a terrific cover also. I think Glenn and Bob McGinnis have very different styles, and it was fun to see two such different artists work on the same book and see how they interpret the material differently. But the short answer is yes, Glenn and Bob are two of our best and two of our most frequent painters.
I find myself just holding this book, looking at the cover over and over, because it's just a wonderful cover. I mean, it's amazing. You think, well, such a simple cover, just a woman holding a camera in an amusement park, but the look on her face, you know, what she's seeing. I mean, there's so much that your imagination goes from there. I mean, wondering what this book is about.
Well, that's what it's for. You know, the whole point of a good pulp cover, and any cover should do this, but most covers don't, is to hook you. You're walking through Grand Central Station. It's 1943. You're busy. You want to get to your job, and you pass a newsstand that has hanging from Bulldog clips 20 different pulp magazines, 20 different magazines full of exciting stories. How are you going to pick one of them or pick any of them? And they competed with each other by having more and more lurid imagery and scenes of menace and suspense so that they'd stop you in your tracks. You'd have to pick it it up. You'd have to buy it because you couldn't pass it by. That's the nature of a pulp cover, and that's what we're trying to revive at Hard Case Crime. We go out of our way to come up with cover art that's not just beautifully painted as a technical matter. We want painters who are really, really talented, but we want images that that make the reader say, or a prospective reader say, I want to know what that story is.
And this is, this is only $12.95, so it's a bargain.
It's a bargain at half the price, and in fact, it is half the price on Amazon. Now, one of our goals, Steve's goal, and one of my goals, is to help support the handful of remaining, it's more than a handful, but it's a dwindling number of independent booksellers across the United States and elsewhere in the world, but in this country in particular, you used to have far more mystery bookstores than you have now, far more bookstores, period. There used to be Borders. There used to be probably more Barnes & Nobles than there are. And I think we would love it if people bought this book in one of those stores. That said, it's also available online, and if you go to Amazon, I think although the cover price is $12.95, I think it's under $7 there. Mm-hmm. I think it's $6-something. And that's fine. You know, people can buy it however they want to buy it, and we're grateful if they do buy it.
There's nothing like the excitement of buying a book you really want to read. I mean, we all know that feeling.
Yeah.
You walk into a bookstore and, wow, I want to read that. And you pick it up and you buy it and you read it. And the joy you get from it. And people don't realize sometimes how much joy you get from reading. I mean, people that don't read, they think, read? Why would I want to read?
Right. What a boring thing to do. Why not play a video game? Well, I like video games, too. There's nothing wrong with them. And there's nothing wrong with movies, radio, TV. But books are special, you know.
And you have to realize that when you play video games, you must have a vivid imagination if you're playing them in the first place, which means you must love to read. I mean, how could you not love to read?
So. Well, there's probably a generation of kids who don't have the patience to turn page after page of nothing but black type on a white piece of paper. And, you know, well, they want the moving pictures. I have a daughter. She's 2.5. A book that has nothing but type in it is a scary prospect to her. It's like swimming underwater, holding your breath for a very long time. She wants little islands of pictures that she can jump on and relax on. But she's 2.5, and I'm confident she's growing up in a house full of books. My wife is a best-selling fantasy author.
Naomi Novik. Yeah, I didn't realize
Naomi Novik. That's right. So she's got lots of books around her. I'm sure that when she's 10 and 15 and 20 and hopefully 40 and 80, she's going to be a lifelong reader. But kids who don't grow up in a house full of books and instead grow up surrounded by televised entertainment, whether that's games or shows, I think it's harder for them to sit still and just look at print. It's a sad thing. And in fact, it may be a good thing that e-books are around, because at least that gives the patina of modernity to the printed word. And it might be that there are some readers who would get turned off, who would get bored with just words on paper, and might get tickled a little bit. Their fancy might get tickled a little bit by words on a screen.
So Joyland, let's talk a little bit about Joyland. It's
sure.
I mean, Stephen King is definitely a horror writer. This has horror elements, but it also has there's a mystery surrounding the book too.
There are three things in this book, and different readers take different things away from it. It's a mystery novel, it's a horror novel, and it's a coming-of-age novel. And I think the coming-of-age element is probably the strongest. It's certainly the most emotional. You've got this young man who's at a crossroads in his life. His first serious girlfriend has dumped him, or is in the process of dumping him, and he takes a summer job at a carnival just basically to heal his bruised heart, you know? He wants to forget the woman who did him wrong. And he discovers friends, and he discovers a kind of family in this environment. He also discovers a mystery. He discovers that a young girl, not really a young girl, a young woman, was murdered, brutally murdered, on the haunted house ride of this small carnival. And her body was dumped from the car, and the killer was never caught. And he starts investigating it. And by the end of the book, I'm not giving away any secrets, he figures out who did it. And the person capable of doing that horrible thing is a dangerous person. And so the horror elements come both from the fact that the murdered girl's ghost is reputed to be haunting the haunted house ride, and from the fact that the killer is still at large and presumably doesn't want his identity made known. So I think there are, as I said, both the horror elements, the supernatural elements, and the mystery elements, and they're both terrific. I really love how in this book Stephen King weaves them together. But what you'll remember at the end of the day, I think more powerfully than than either the whodunit or the exact details of the suspense scenes and the scary scenes, is the emotional life of these characters. It's how heartbreaking it is when people talk about losing people they love. The book's a lot about time and growing old and how some people don't ever get to grow old because they die in their youth, either murdered or there's a young boy who has a serious illness in the book, and he's his doctors have said he won't live past a certain young age. And how do you live in a world that contains these kinds of unfair fates? Well, you do, because we all do, and we have no choice. And that kind of meditation on serious topics, serious philosophical topics, that's what makes the book so special to me. You know, when you get to the end of the book, you'll be in tears. I was. I don't cry easily. I don't cry easily at books.
Every book you publish, do you have to like it before it's published?
Yes. Yes, I have to like it a lot. We get 1,000 submissions a year, and we only publish 4 books a year. So we have to say no to well over 99% of all the books we see, even excellent ones. We have no choice. You know, if out of 1,000 books, 10% are good, that's still 100.
Well, what makes the difference? I mean, what makes the difference between an excellent book and I mean, something that you'll publish and something that's just excellent?
You know, part of it's just magic. Part of it's chemistry. It's the indefinable thing where a particular reader reads a particular book, and it just grabs him. It just engages him, and he can't put it down. And if I'm the reader, if it engages me, if I can't put it down, I'll probably buy it. But you can be more helpful than that. I can answer your question more helpfully. A book has to be extremely well written. The prose has to be confident. It has to have the confidence of a professional writer of prose, as opposed to the stumbling, halting approach of a novice. There's nothing wrong with being a novice writer, but right. We're not the line to publish your work. Unless you're a first-time writer who happens to be brilliant. We do have those once in a while. I want a story that's not entirely familiar. Obviously, we've all read stories about murders. We've all read stories about bank robberies. It's not going to be completely new if you write a story about murders and bank robberies, but I want there to be something fresh and novel about it. I don't want to feel I'm just reading the same scenes I've read 1,000 times before. So there's that. The characters should make me want to be in their company for 200 or 300 pages. There are a lot of characters out there that are perfectly good characters to write about, but I don't want to spend 200 pages reading about them. There are a bunch of different factors, but the biggest one in the end is when I start reading, I turn page 1, get to page 2, do I want to keep going? Am I hungry to keep going? And the very best books I find are like that. You know, it's 2 in the morning and I have to keep reading because I need to know what happens next.
And it's interesting because one of the big mysteries in the beginning of the book is why this girlfriend of his is keeping him at arm's length. And I don't know whether that's going to be resolved at the end of the book because I haven't gotten to the end yet. But
I'm not going to spoil it for you, and I'm certainly not going to spoil it for all the listeners out there. But, you know, sometimes in asking this question, why does a girl keep a guy at arm's length or vice versa? These are mysteries far harder to solve than whodunit. You know, I think
true.
The mysteries of the human heart don't have tidy solutions. And that's part of what the book's about. You know, every page has every section of the book is separated from every other section by a little image of a heart. And that was Steve's request. And it's because the book's really about affairs of the heart. It's about matters of the heart. It's about being heartbroken. And it's basically a love story.
Yeah, people out there are saying, why does he keep calling him Steve? Isn't his name Stephen King? So
yeah,
it's like how everybody...
He goes by Steve. It's like Lawrence Block goes by Larry. And if you talk to him frequently, you call him Lawrence, he's going to think you're crazy. I go by Charles. Some Charleses go by Charlie, so I try to remember what people like to be called and use that. But it is a little weird when somebody's famous, when there's a celebrity and he's known by a certain name. I can imagine that E.F. Hutton or J.P. Morgan were probably not called E.F. or J.P. by their buddies. They were probably called John and Edward. Anyway, I agree with you. It does sound funny to talk about Stephen King that way. I wonder about people who write with pseudonyms, you know, actual complete pseudonyms. Like John le Carré's real name is not John le Carré. I forget whether it's Bernard Cornwell or David Cornwell, something like that.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Does anyone call him John? I don't know.
It's like being like calling John Grisham Johnny. You know, it's like, how weird would that sound? You know?
But that might be what his friends call him. I have no idea. I've never met John Grisham. I can tell you that. It is interesting. Yeah, look, I write under a pseudonym, and I'll tell you, it's weird. If somebody, I wrote 2 books for Hard Case Crime, Songs of Innocence and Little Girl Lost, under the fake name Richard Alias.
Really?
Richard Alias is, it was the 4th book and the 33rd book in the series. And I'm very proud of them. They were both nominated for awards. One of them, Songs of Innocence, won the Seamus Award, same award that Max Phillips won. Books I'm very proud of. The name, the pseudonym, was sort of a tip of a hat to the old-time pulp writers who all wrote under fake names. All of them did. Ed McBain was not Ed McBain's real name. His real name was Salvatore Lombino.
Dean Quincy has like 17 different names.
Yeah, exactly. Westlake has a ton. ton, Block is a ton. So I decided I'd write under a pseudonym. But it's not my name. It's not like anyone ever calls me Richard. But once in a while, I'll get an email or I'll get a phone call from someone, and they know me as the writer of that book, and they say Richard or they say Rich. It's not my name, and it feels very weird. But of course, to them, I'm the guy who wrote that book, and so.
Well, isn't it a little bit exciting to have a different name though on books?
Yes, it's terrific. I love multiple identities. What a terrific, entertaining thing to do. Haven't we all wanted to be spies and detectives and, you know, skulking mysterious figures when we grew up? You know, this is a chance to wear a mask like the Lone Ranger.
Now, why are some of the Hardcase crime novels in hardcover and some in paperback? And what makes you decide which to put in hardcover and which to put in paperback?
It's a good question. That's a new development. The first 66 books were all done in small pocket-sized paperback. That's it. No difference. When we switched from Dorchester to Titan, Titan was a company that did some hardcover books. They did some beautiful hardcover books. They did art books and compilations of comic strips and so on. And they said, we think you should put out some of your books in hardcover. And we were open to the idea. You know, we're around mostly to revive the look and feel of the old paperbacks, but that doesn't mean we can't do a hardcover now and then. So we said, okay, we'll try it. And we talked about how to pick the books. So we said, if a book is major enough, prominent enough, that it feels like a disservice to the author not to have a hardcover edition to memorialize this book, to sit in libraries where paperback books get destroyed after they've passed through a large number of hands, but hardcovers live longer. We'll do a hardcover then. So, for example, our first five Lawrence Block titles were all reprints. They were rare books. These were reprints of books that were very obscure, so we were very proud to bring them back. But they weren't written for us. The first book he ever wrote for us was Getting Off. And that is, well, you know, it's about a woman who commits crimes and gets off. She doesn't get charged. She's not found guilty. She doesn't go to jail. She gets off.
But it's interesting how titles have double names. I mean,
yeah,
like,
well, she gets off in that sense too. But in any event,
that's right. You know, it's like,
so that book, we said, let's put that out in hardcover. It's the first brand new original novel Lawrence Block has ever written for us. It's probably the last one he'll ever write for us. It's special. Let's put that one out in hardcover. So that was our first hardcover. Then we found an unpublished novel by Donald Westlake, a great writer. People love Donald Westlake.
Yeah, the axe is an all-time.
Oh, the axe is fantastic. And this one was called The Comedy Is Finished. And we said, we'll do that one in hardcover. So that was our second. Then we had a first novel that was just mammoth. It was the length of three books because it was written in the form of three separate books. The conceit, the concept behind the book was, it's called The 20-Year Death by Ariel Winter. It's a first novel, so it's not a writer that already has an existing readership. But his concept was, I'm going to write about these two characters as if they were written by three different writers. So I'll write a book about them in the style of George Simenon, another book about the same two characters in the style of Raymond Chandler, and then another book about the same characters in the style of Jim Thompson, and I'll bind them together in a single volume. And this was going to be a 700-page book, and it was brilliant. The book's just incredibly, it may be the single best book we've ever published. It's outstanding. We said, you know what, let's do hardcover for that. Let's give this book a little bit more of a launching platform. There might be reviewers, for example, who would review it in hardcover, who wouldn't review it if it were in paperback original. So we did that as a hardcover. And then finally, we had a new book by James M. Cain, the unpublished final novel by the author of The Postman Always Rings Twice.
Yeah.
And we said, that deserves to be a hardcover. So we've only done those four books in hardcover. That's it. We didn't even do, well, there's Joyland, which I said we did as a collectible for just 2,000 copies or so. But that really is it. And we will probably do more at some point, but we don't have any more planned right now. We will only do it in the case of something really big. All of our books are good. We're proud of all of them. We love the paperback format. We do not want to be disdainful towards it. We want to celebrate it. But once in a while, you have a book that's sort of higher profile where having a hardcover also will maximize review coverage. We'll get into the hands of some people who only buy hardcovers. It's worth doing. By the way, I should say, every book we do in hardcover, we then also do in paperback. It's not either or. We eventually, a year later, do a paperback edition.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. In case people can't afford to pay the
exactly.
Prices.
Yeah, no, we come back with a paperback eventually. It's not, none of our books are only in hardcover. I guess, okay, so there's always an exception to every rule, right? The two collectible books we did with Subterranean Press, the ones that I told you earlier were numbered HCC 69 and HCC 70. Those two came from a collectible house that doesn't do paperbacks. So those two are only in hardcover. But those are kind of a special case. Those really were printed in very small runs just for collectors.
Right, exactly. I think they do Robert McCammon's books now, Subterranean Place.
I think that may be true. And they've done a bunch of Stephen King's books, too.
It's interesting. I wonder, well, suppose, I won't name any names or anything, but
sure.
If you had a big-time author that come to you, somebody who was really, really popular, and you didn't like the book as much as you liked the one that's already been published, would you still publish it?
Well, if I hated it, I wouldn't. I mean, if I thought it was a noxious or a poisonous book, you know, if
obviously, if Stephen King gives you another book, it's going to be hard to turn it down and say, no, we don't want to publish it, you know?
It'll be hard to turn it down in part because I'm likely to like it. I've read not every book Stephen King has ever published, but I've probably read 20 of them, and I've liked all of them. So the odds that Stephen King will write a book I don't like are pretty low. I happen to like his work. There are writers I don't like. You know, I would turn down a book by a big-name author if I didn't like it.
How long does it take you to know whether it's a book you're going to publish? I mean,
sometimes it takes as little as a page to know it's a book I won't publish. I have to read the whole thing to know it's a book I will publish. Because, for example, let's imagine I read the first half of a book and I absolutely love it. I'm not going to make an offer on that basis because what if the ending is bad? So I do have to read the whole thing, and these days I'm so busy, I've got a ton of work. It takes me a long time to read a whole book. So it sometimes will take me a month to get from one end of a book to another because I'm doing so many other things. But all it takes is one reading. If I love a book, I know I love it, and then it's just a question of whether I can fit it into the schedule. We, as I said, we don't publish very many books. So if I read 10 books that I love and can only publish 4, I still have to say no to 6. But it doesn't take me long to decide that I would like to publish a book. Sometimes there's a book that's extremely well written that's just not right for us. So, for example, other than Stephen King's new book, which does have paranormal elements, ghosts, we don't really publish books with anything supernatural in them. You know, if a writer is really outstanding, would I consider it? Maybe. If it's Stephen King, I'll certainly consider it. But generally speaking, we're not the right line for ghosts or fairies or werewolves or vampires. We don't do science fiction. We don't do spaceships. We don't do books set in ancient Egypt. These are all fine things. I love these books. We don't do spy stories.
Now, do you have a lot of collectors that collect your books? I mean,
we do, although we wouldn't necessarily know how many we have because there's no obligation for them to tell us. But we do hear from time to time people write to us over the trance and they say, I buy 2 copies of every book you publish, 1 to read and 1 to put in Mylar and keep for posterity. That's always fun to hear. We have collectors, no question. Some of them are hardcore and ask questions like, how can I tell the difference between a first printing and a second printing of this book? And sometimes there's no way, there's no answer. Some of them are more casual. They just say, I love your cover art. I love how your spines all look sitting on my shelf because all of our books have the same spine. You know, most publishers have, the spine of the book is different for every book, but our books are all exactly the same. The white background, black type, red type, author name, title.
And that's intentional.
No, it's intentional. We want people to be able to spot a hard case crime book even when it's just the spine showing on a bookstore shelf. We want them to say, I know that spine. It's got the yellow ribbon at the top. It's got white, red, and black in the below it. And if I see that from 20 feet away, I know it's a hard case crime book. Nobody else.
And people have to trust you. I mean, obviously, you said with Ariel Winter, a lot of people had never heard that name before.
Nobody had ever heard that name before except Ariel Winter's friends and family. He hadn't published a book before. He really hadn't even published short stories before.
It's so bad, I thought it was a woman, you know?
There you go. Well, you're not the only one. Several people thought Ariel, like the Little Mermaid, but it's actually Ariel. So in terms of trust, that's exactly right. You know, somebody says, I've liked other hard case crime books, I'll give this one a try. It's long, it's expensive because it's a hardcover, I've never heard of this writer, but you know what? Hard case crime, I trust those guys. They publish good books, so I'll give it a shot. And it did very well. That book did far better. It did better than many books by better known authors that we've published. It wasn't a bestseller, but it did very well, in part because the New York Times ran a review that called it extraordinary, and it got nominated for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. So there were many reasons people found it. But one of the reasons is that they knew hard case crime and they trust us. I liken that to being similar to a magazine, right? If you subscribe to a magazine, you're doing it because you trust the editor to publish articles each month that you'll find interesting. You have no guarantee, right? You buy one issue of Time magazine, you have no guarantee that the next issue will be something you like.
That's true.
The editor. You trust that this set of editors will come up with stuff you find interesting every week. So it's like that. Hard case crime is a little bit like that, where if you like the first 5 you read, you'll probably like the next 5 you read. So feel free to pick them up, even if you don't know the author's work.
And Stephen, it's like watching. Some people don't like Adam Sandler, and
that's true.
You see he's in the movie, you're like, oh, I don't know if I even want to see it because I don't like Adam Sandler.
Sometimes that's negative branding.
Right. Sometimes you just have to get through that and just watch the movie anyway. You know,
Absolutely. No, it goes both ways, right? So somebody could say hard case crime. I don't really like hard-boiled crime fiction. It's too tough. There's too much violence. There's too much sex. Whatever it is. So somebody might say, I don't want to pick up a hard case crime book. That's okay too. You know, we're not the.
You're not for everybody.
Exactly. We're right. We're not trying to be everything for everybody. I think having a strong brand means knowing what you are and what you aren't and communicating that clearly. If you are, you know, Boar's Head and you make salty ham, turkey, and chicken cold cuts, nobody wants to buy toothpaste from you.
I think it's fascinating that you can tell sometimes by one page that they're not going to publish a book.
Well, sometimes it's because it's illiterate, it's not well written, it's very clearly not at the level that we would require. If I'm turning down a book after reading one page, it's got to be pretty bad.
I've often had that conversation with friends about when do you put a book down? I mean, how long do you give a book until you just say, this is not my kind of book?
And the difference is, right, if you pick up a book, some editor has already approved it, right? Some publishing house has already
why did that?
Somebody liked it.
Yeah.
But when I get a submission, I can't assume anybody liked it, right? Because a large fraction of the submissions I get are I'm the first person seeing them other than the writer, and most of them are going to be terrible.
And, I can't even think of the last book that I was grabbed by page one, where just page
That's
one got me. So, because, I mean, books, I have found books lately to be very slow in the beginning.
Yeah, they're definitely, a lot of them are very long. Publishers now say, I want my book to be at least 350 pages. In the old days, most books were 150 pages. They had very small type, of course. That's why they were so few pages. They wanted to save money on paper. But even if you adjust for the small type, they were typically 50 to 75,000 words. That was a typical paperback length. But now, a paperback, if it's not 350 pages, if it's not 100, 150, 200,000 words, people think you're not getting your money's worth, and that's nonsense. You know, you want a story that reads quickly, that hooks you quickly, that gets you into the middle of the action quickly, and it'll be delicious. You don't want to meander around for 50 pages with the character's interior monologue and stories about, you know, did he wet the bed when he grew up? You don't care, you know, did Humphrey Bogart's character in Casablanca need a backstory? Do we need to know where Rick went to college? Do we need to know if he went to college?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you read Philip Marlowe novels by Raymond Chandler, they're brilliant. Do we need to know, you know, what Philip Marlowe was like as an 8-year-old? Of course not. But if you're filling 350 pages, by God, you're going to tell the reader that because you've got to fill it with something.
Now, have there been any of these, the hard case crime, where you've read the first page and been instantly hooked?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There have been a number of them. And there have certainly been plenty where it's been within the first 5 pages. And not just our books, you know. I read Horns by Stephen King's son, Joe Hill.
That's a great book, yeah.
Terrific book. I think within 2 pages I was hooked.
What did you think of his new one? I'm curious. The NOS...
Nosferatu,
yeah.
As I assume he pronounces it. It's the license plate spelling.
But I never thought of that. Why did I never think of that?
I think it's Nosferatu.
Did you read the whole thing?
I have not read any of it yet. I will. I'm a huge fan of his. I think he's brilliant. I think his books are absolutely unputdownable. You cannot stop reading.
Now, are they a little too hard? Are they a little too graphic for you to publish one?
No, I'd publish one in a heartbeat. Of course, if he wrote one for us, he'd probably change the style a little. He's tweeted on Twitter. He's tweeted that he'd like to write a book for us, and in fact, that he'd like to write a book one day on a manual typewriter. He doesn't want to use a word processor or a computer. He wants to type it on a manual typewriter to get the feeling of the old pulp writers. And I've told him, I'll take it anytime. Write it, I will take it. I cannot imagine his writing a book that I wouldn't want to publish. He's terrific.
Right.
I have not read Nosferatu yet.
I wanted to interview him. He wouldn't even let me interview him. I don't know. I guess he doesn't like me or something. But
I don't know if he doesn't like you. He may just not know you. He might, and he's busy. You know, he was probably in the middle of writing. He was in the middle of promoting his book. I would cut him some slack.
Yeah.
But, he's a great writer. I haven't picked up the new one yet, but I will, and absolutely expect to be hooked by it. I've heard that it's a long book, so it's like Game of Thrones. I know I'm going to love Game of Thrones, but that's 5 long books, and I just don't have the time. So I wait till I've got a week's vacation, and I can read a long book, and that's when I'll read it.
Now, have you ever had any authors that you wanted to publish a hard case crime novel, and they said no? Not that.
Oh yeah. Well, obviously, any writer who's living and would have to write the book for us, we can't pay as much as some of the big houses. So if we go to a writer and the writer's not extremely prolific and it would take him 6 months or a year to write a book, and all we could pay was the relatively modest amount that a small labor of love operation can pay, it's completely reasonable for them to say, listen, I just can't do it. I can't spend 6 months or 12 months of my professional life writing a book for the very modest amount you guys can afford.
Well, I didn't realize it.
Yeah, so half our line is brand new, but half of it is reprints, and it's wonderful reprints. So once in a while, I'll find a reprint from an author who's alive, and I'll go to the author, and I'll say, here's this existing book. You have to do no work, zero work. There's nothing for you to do except cash the check. That's it. It's not a big check, but it's a check, and why turn down the money? And they'll say, I'm not proud of this book. I wrote it early in my career. I don't want to have my name on it now. And I'll say, but I love the book. It's a terrific book. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a book you can be proud of. But they've moved on in their lives, and they're not proud of it anymore. And they say, no, don't, please don't reprint it. And as long as they own the rights, they have every right to say that. If a book's old enough and has fallen into the public domain, then they don't have the right to prevent publication.
So there's a bunch you'd love to publish and just can't. That's amazing.
Well, it's not a huge bunch, but there's some. I'll give you an example. There's a writer named Alan Furst. Alan Furst he's very well respected. He writes very serious, exactly. World War II, espionage novels, novels of political intrigue, and they're terrific. He's a very gifted writer. But he started his career writing three novels about a pot dealer. And they were comic romps. They were very funny. They were crime novels. The first of them was called Your Day in the Barrel. And it is so good that it was nominated for the Edgar Allan Poe Award, which is the highest honor in the mystery field, as best first novel. I don't think it won, but it was nominated, and it deserved to be. It's a terrific book. So here's this book, Your Turn in the Barrel, or Your Day in the Barrel. And Alan Furst has never allowed it to be reprinted, because now he's thought of as this serious... this is my theory. He's thought of as this serious writer of serious books, and he doesn't want to have his pot novel, you know, pot dealer comedy revived. And it's a shame because it's a terrific book. It's one of my favorite comic crime novels, and he ought to let it be reprinted. But
maybe he'll hear this and change his mind.
Maybe he will. It's possible. I talked to him. He didn't change his mind then. And there's another one. Let's see. The other one is Martin Cruz Smith, who became famous for Gorky Park, but he started his career writing pseudonymous novels about a character called the Inquisitor, who was an agent for the Vatican, and these were they were a little pulpy, and some of them were a little cheesy, but the best of them, there were six, and the best two are really terrific reads. They're great fun. But and he came close. He said yes, but then at the last minute, when he was ready to sign the contract, he pulled the plug, and I've never understood why. I've never understood why he changed his mind, but again, it's his privilege. He can say yes or no.
Yeah, that's true. There's not much you can do about that.
Exactly.
Now, tell me about this Armored Car novel that's coming out. I'm curious about this. I mean, I saw it.
We haven't told anybody. I will tell you a little bit about it, and your listeners will be the first to hear anything about
it. When is it coming out, first of all?
It's coming out for Christmas next year.
Okay.
It's Christmas 2014, and which probably means it'll be in stores in November.
Now, you've already read it.
I've read it. I'm in the process
of working
on it.
Lucky you.
I love it. It's great. So we love heist novels, but heist novels are hard to write. You know, Ocean's 11 was a great casino heist movie, but there's no novel it was based on. I just love heist novels. There are some people who do them very well, and most of them aren't alive anymore. Westlake did them well. Lionel White did them well. There are a bunch, but those guys are all gone. And so the question is there some writer out there who can write this kind of story? And so we got a submission from a writer named Dan Boyd, and it's a pseudonym. It's a pseudonym of a man who was a police officer himself. He's retired now. He used to be police chief, in fact.
We wouldn't recognize that name, that real name?
I don't think people would tend to recognize the real name, although he's known in some circles. But he's not famous. It's not that.
Right.
But he comes from a police background, and he really knows his stuff. And he wrote a book that I just fell in love with from the first page on, which is the story of two men who rob an armored car the week before Christmas in the middle of a blizzard. The snow is coming down. They successfully get the money out of the armored car. I'm not giving too much away there. That happens early in the book. But now, how do they get away with it? And they're driving in the snow. They can barely see out the window. The police are on their trail. They have to take the loot into a national park reserve, and some very unusual things are going on there. And it's just a blast. And it's the first Christmas book we've ever published. It's going to be our first Christmas novel. But it's a Christmas novel in the same way that Die Hard was a Christmas movie.
I wish it were coming out this Christmas, because it sounds fascinating.
I know. Wouldn't that be great? But we have to have time to paint the cover. Glenn Orbick is doing that cover. It's going to be terrific. And, you know, it takes time to paint. We have to have time to...
Well, and that begs the question that when you get a book that you really want to publish, from the time that you read it and say, we're going to publish this, until it's published, what's the usual gap?
1 year.
1 year. So it takes about a year for you to get that out.
About a year, right. I mean, this book we bought now, and it'll come out next Christmas. That's a little more than a year. But it's just so perfect. We could probably rush it out sooner.
Right.
But there's no point in having a book that takes place in a snowstorm at Christmas. The right time to put that book out is Christmas.
Absolutely.
Clearly.
I agree.
And I think there are a lot of people who will really enjoy the idea of a hard case crime Christmas, because it's so different. You know, it's not sweetness and light. But on the other hand, in some interesting ways, it almost is. So it's a lot of fun. It's a fun book.
You're absolutely riveting. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating to talk to you, because your mind is going a mile a minute. I can hear it.
Well, yours too. We're both fast thinkers, fast talkers, native New Yorker.
But let's talk about something, the ones that are coming out between now and the next Christmas.
Absolutely. The next book, after Joyland. So Joyland is in stores now. Anyone who wants it can get it. The next book is coming out in October. It's called The Secret Lives of Married Women. And it's only our second female author ever. Our first female author was Krista Faust, who wrote Money Shot and Chokehold, which are two of our most successful books. Krista is terrific. We have never published another woman. And this is a book by Alyssa Wald, who made headlines 12 years ago when she published her last novel, which was a fictional, it was a novel inspired by a relationship she had with a firefighter, and it was called Holding Fire, and it was a terrific book, but she hasn't published a book since. So it's been 12 years.
It isn't a romance novel, it's a real mystery.
No. It is a crime novel. That said, there are elements in it. I don't know if I'd call them romance exactly. Let's call them sex.
Okay.
It is a novel.
Even better, you know?
Right. It has our possibly our most scandalous cover yet.
Really?
Also a Glenn Orbit cover. It shows a woman completely naked sitting on a sheet, and there's a man standing behind her fully dressed, and he's got his necktie tied around her eyes like a blindfold, and she's smiling very happily. And it is, in part, the story of two identical twin sisters who are married and whose relationships with their husbands are falling on sort of rocky shoals, and violence enters their lives and changes their lives. And there's an element of S&M in the books. It's a topic that's on people's minds now a lot because of 50 Shades of Grey, but I will say without hesitation that this book is 100 times better written than 50 Shades of Grey. And the exploration of the allure of submission, the forbidden allure of submission, is much more serious and much more emotional and much more gripping.
Is there a murder in it?
There is a murder in it. There is at least one murder in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true of every one of your books. Is there a murder in every hard case crime novel?
No, there's probably at least one hard case crime book that is just about a robbery.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think which one it is. Most of our books have at least one dead body.
Right.
But there might be one that doesn't. That's an interesting question. I'll have to go back and look. I bet there's at least one.
So that's coming out in what month now?
That's October of this year. Then we jump ahead to next year, and next year we'll publish four books. The first book is going to be a new novel about the hitman known as Quarry by Max Allen Collins. It's called The Wrong Quarry, and it's coming out to roughly coincide with the premiere, hopefully, on Cinemax of a Quarry TV series.
Really?
So we've published four or five Quarry books. They're terrific. They're some of our most popular books. And it's about this ruthless hitman. He's a professional killer, and he gets assignments, and he carries them out. But in the course of carrying out his assignments, he does some investigation. He's almost like a detective to figure out who is it that wants his client dead. So his modus operandi is that he will go to somebody who's the target of another hitman, and he'll offer his services to kill the other hitman. And so he has to investigate to find out who the other hitman is and why do they want this client.
Now, how many Quarry books are there? I mean, is this a series that he writes?
No, it's a series of about 10 books. He started them in the 1970s, before we were around, and he published the first five before we came around. Then there was a hiatus of maybe 20 years, and he has published five with us since, so there have been about 10 total. So we're going to have a new Quarry book, The Wrong Quarry, that's coming out in, I think, New Year's Day, January 2nd.
And once again, you've already read it, so.
Oh, it's a good one. You'll like this one. So I've read all of them. So that's Quarry. Then in May, we haven't even announced all these books yet, so your listeners are getting a real earful. In May, we have a long-lost book by Lawrence Block that no one alive today knows, except Block himself. Nobody knows he wrote. It's a book set on the Mexican-Texas border, and it reads like a Tarantino film. It reads like a fever dream of violence and bloodshed, and it's just It is a jaw-dropping book. I won't reveal the title yet because we haven't announced it, but there is a Lawrence Block novel that none of his fans have read, and I think people will really get a kick out of it.
If anybody's ever met Lawrence Block, he's the most unusual man you'll ever meet, say the least.
I don't know. I've met some pretty unusual men.
I don't know. I mean, he's just so different from anybody you'll ever meet, in my opinion.
One day, next time we talk, I have to ask you how so. But Lawrence Block is great. He's a brilliant writer. He's probably my favorite living crime writer, period. And he's one of the giants. There are not many giants left. Elmore Leonard, Lawrence Block, most of the others.
And he's probably the best reader of any book I've ever... I mean, when he reads a book out loud, it's fascinating.
He's a great reader. He tells jokes. He's a great raconteur. He's great. So we've got a Lawrence Block book. Then the third book, you know what the fourth book is? It's the Christmas book.
Right, the Christmas
third
book.
The other last book of the year. What's the third, not the fourth?
Now, you didn't tell me that. You didn't say the title of the Christmas book yet, did you?
I didn't. It's called Easy Death.
Easy Death. All right. You can tell me that title. How about that?
Yeah, I want to keep the block title secret. We'll announce it soon. There's a book by a film director, deceased, named Samuel Fuller. He's a cult figure. Samuel Fuller directed movies like The Big Red One, The Naked Kiss, Shock Corridor, Pick Up on South Street.
Shock Corridor, I love that.
Shock Corridor. It's a great title. It's a great movie. He made movies that were outrageous. They were provocative. They were scandalous. And he also wrote a few novels. The last novel he ever wrote was never published in English. He was living in exile in France, and he wrote it in France, and it got published in French. He wrote it in English, but it got published in French, and also, I don't know why, in Japanese. Those are the only languages in which the book has ever been published, so fans of Fuller have never read this book. It's about a mafia bagman who gets in over his head when he falls in love with the widow of a gangster. It's a terrific book. This is a filmmaker who inspired Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, Steven Spielberg, Francis Ford Coppola. Coppola almost cast him in The Godfather. Spielberg did cast him in a little cameo appearance in 1941. This man has influenced a whole generation of great filmmakers, and we have his final novel, and no one's read it. I'm very excited about this book.
But you have now.
I have now.
You
I'm working on editing it now, which is it's tricky to edit a book by an author who's not alive, but I've now had the privilege to do that with a number of writers, including Donald Westlake, including James M. Cain, and so I will just bring the same care.
So you're a really accomplished editor, too.
Well, thank you for saying that. I've been doing it for about 20 years.
You have a lot of talents.
Well, I'll let you say that and be modest and not say it myself, but I do think that you get better the more you do something, and I am certainly a better editor now than I was 25 years ago when I got my start. And I really feel it's an honor to get to touch the work of these authors that I love. I grew up reading James M. Cain. I never dreamed I would get to edit his final novel. I grew up watching the movies of Sam Fuller. I never dreamed I would get to edit a Samuel Fuller book. I mean, and this guy wasn't just, by the way, wasn't just a filmmaker. He was one of the men who landed on Omaha Beach in World War II. You remember the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan?
Oh, absolutely. How could you forget that?
Yeah. He was one of the American soldiers who liberated the Falkenau concentration camp. He was the youngest crime reporter in the history of New York newspapers. He was 16 and on the crime beat. This guy was extraordinary.
Do you put all this information in the books, all this
facts? We generally don't. We don't do biographical sketches just because they didn't do those in the old paperbacks, and we want to be as similar. But we have a couple of times. So, for instance, Mickey Spillane started writing a book for us just before he died.
He
got close to the end, but he didn't finish it, and he asked Max Allen Collins to finish it for him. And when we published that book, which was called Dead Street, we had a little note at the end about Mickey Spillane, his importance in the field, and how he asked Max to do this. It just seemed appropriate there. I did an essay at the end of the James M. Cain book explaining the genesis of that book and how we found it. Once in a while we'll do that. We don't generally do it. You know what? I probably will, in Fuller's case, I'll probably do an essay at the end just because his life was so extraordinary. And people should know about it. I think it's important for people not just to read and enjoy the book, but know who this man was that wrote it because he was so special.
We have so many exciting things coming up. I mean, your life has got to be a lot of fun.
It's fun. I mean, not to say I never have a bad day, but it's fun. I feel very lucky.
Your confidence comes through too. I mean, you sound very, very confident, and that's nice. I mean, there's so many things to be, you know, when you look at life. Life can be very difficult a lot of times.
It's true. Look, I'm not confident about everything. I've got a 2-year-old daughter. You look at this fragile creature who's not even half your size, and you think, how is this young girl's life going to be? And I'd love to protect her and know that she was always going to turn out fine. And you can't know that. You want to hear me not be confident. That's what I'm not confident about. I look at the world and all the violence in the world. I look at all the craziness going on. I look at the economy. There are plenty of things I'm not confident about. There's a reason I like noir fiction. There's a reason I like crime fiction. It's very dark stuff.
But you get up in the to get up in the morning and to do what you love to do. I mean, you love
that
books.
Part is great. Yes, I'm an odd mixture of an optimist and a pessimist.
I mean, how many people get that opportunity to do exactly what they want to do?
Very, very few, and I feel profoundly grateful that I do, and that I've had enough success at it that I can keep doing it. You know, there are plenty of people who write, who dream of being a writer, and they slave away at a book mornings, nights, whenever they find a spare moment, and they get one book written, and they put it out, and it sells 100 copies, and they never write another book. That kind of thing is tragic to me, because if it's what they love to do, it's heartbreaking that they don't get to do it again, that they get to do it once in their life and never again. Now, some people are satisfied with that. They just want to do one, and they only have one book in them. That's fine. There's nothing heartbreaking about that. That's great. But the people who dream that they could write books, that they could edit books, that they could work in this field, whatever the field is, if they don't get to do it, that is heartbreaking. We only have one go-round on this earth, and we have to try to fill it with as much stuff that satisfies us and pleases us and makes the world a better place as we can. I won't say hard case crime books make the world a better place the way the Salk vaccine did, but, you know, I think entertaining people is an important duty, and we are making people that much happier. And to bring it back to Joyland, the book that we're talking about, right. You know, there's a scene where the kids who are going to work over the summer at the amusement park get a speech from the man who owns the amusement park, who's ancient, very old man. He says,
he's a character already, yeah.
That's right. You've seen it. He says, we sell fun. That's what we don't sell cars. We don't sell insurance policies. We don't sell boats, and we don't sell trips. We sell fun. That's what we're here for. That's our job. And that's true of everyone in the writing industry, too, unless you're writing, you know, nonfiction exposés or something. But anyone who writes novels, we sell fun, and it's a great privilege to.
That's what makes Stephen King so wonderful. He writes about the regular person. He writes about the bum on the street. He writes about the carnival guy. He writes about, I mean, everybody he writes about. You have this clear picture in your head of what they're really like, and when they start speaking,
characters beautifully.
Yeah, and when they start speaking, and it's like, wow. This is just great stuff, you know, just what he comes up with, the thing and the phrases they use, and it's
all very down to earth, and it sounds like people you really meet and you really know, absolutely. And you might think that after writing so many books, it might become harder for him to keep the characters feeling fresh and the dialogue feeling fresh, and I don't know if it is hard or easy, but he keeps doing it. He pulls it off time after time. When I got the manuscript for Joyland and just started reading it and couldn't put it down, I this huge smile spread across my face. It feels wonderful to read a book that's written so well. So I very much hope your listeners give it a try. I think they'll enjoy it if they do.
I think they will.
I loved it. And if they're inclined toward this genre, I hope they try some of our other books too.
You know, when I first called you, I had no idea what you were going to be like. I mean, we've never talked before ever, other than email. You don't get any impression from email what people are like. But
no, you really
you're
don't.
Just the most fascinating guy. I mean, you really are. It's been a pleasure.
It sounds like we should be going out on a date.
Yeah, it sounds like we should have lunch sometime.
Yeah,
we should
well,
do.
One day I'm sure we will, and that'll be fun. But in the meantime, I am delighted that I got to do an interview with you. And I looked through your site. I saw some of the people who you've done interviews with. They're all bigger and better known than I am, and rightly so. I am the least interesting person of all the people you've interviewed, but I am delighted that I got to do it.
No, I find you absolutely fascinating. I think everybody.
Well,
and it's been great talking to you. And the book again is Joyland. It's in all your bookstores. And can people actually order it online from your site too?
They can't order it from our site. We don't sell things directly from our site, just because we don't have any facility. We don't have a warehouse or a staff people to stuff things in envelopes. But they can get it on Amazon, BN.com. They can get it from their local bookstore if they are lucky enough to still have a local bookstore. They can certainly get it from the big chains. If there are big chains out there, Barnes & Noble has it. Walmart probably has some copies. I think some drugstores have it.
Right.
A guy wrote to me saying he saw it in a military PX.
Oh, really?
Which made me very happy, because that's where you used to find these old novels.
Right.
I think you'll be able to find it. If you want Joyland, you can find it. Some of our other books are less ubiquitous and harder to find, but I guarantee if you go online, you'll be able to find our books.
Great, wonderful. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.